This is Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm your host, Dave Gorham. I'm a retired meteorologist with a career in the United States Air Force, commercial and broadcast weather forecasting, with a specialty of aviation meteorology. I've provided weather support to Air Force One from Joint Base Andrews in Washington, D.C., and to Marine One from the Presidential Retreat at Camp David. I've briefed military and corporate flight crews around the world. I've been both a television and radio broadcast meteorologist and have spent a large part of my career providing commercial weather support to clients in all parts of the world. I've created this podcast series to bring you interesting but tragic stories of airplane crashes that are either caused by the weather or when the weather is a contributing factor to the crash. Today's episode, When the B-52 Lost Its Tail and Crashed into Elephant Mountain, is about an unusual crash of a United States Air Force B-52 bomber in 1963. The plane, while attempting to escape severe turbulence, lost its vertical stabilizer and rudder, essentially losing its ability to fly straight. The plane pitched strongly to the right and downward, then crashed into a mountain in north-central Maine, located in the far northeastern corner of the United States. The crash killed 7 of the 9 crew members. 2 crew members survived. One spent the frigid January night in shoulder-deep snow, and the other found himself stuck in a tree with temperatures far below zero as they waited to be found and rescued. This story is about the men and the plane, one of the most well-known Air Force planes and perhaps one of the most well-known planes in the world. We'll also look at the weather conditions that led to the crash, the crash site memorial established after the crash, and the changes in aircraft design that impacted not only future generations of the B-52 bomber, but the airliners we all fly in today. As the sun rose on Friday, January 25th, 1963, Air Force Captain Gerald Adler surveyed his situation. It wasn't good. The airplane he was aboard had crashed into the side of a mountain the day before. Though he had managed to eject from the crippled plane, his emergency parachute did not deploy, and he struck the ground while still in his ejection seat. It's estimated that he hit the ground with the force of 16 Gs, or 16 times the force of gravity. The ground was covered in about 5 feet of snow, so it helped to cushion the impact. But it was still a tremendous hit. His skull was fractured, and 3 ribs were broken. Once on the ground, he had either crawled from his ejection seat, or the ground had forcibly separated him from it. But the force of the impact had twisted and bent the ejection seat in such a way that he could not access the survival kit that had been ejected with him. To fight the cold as best he could through the night, he wrapped himself in his parachute. Overnight temperatures were in the minus 30 Fahrenheit range, or about minus 34 Celsius. The extreme cold would eventually lead to frostbite of his feet, gangrene, double pneumonia, and the amputation of a leg. But a full account of his injuries by the young Air Force captain would not occur until 5 days later, when he awoke from an extended period of unconsciousness. He spent 14 months in the hospital. He does not remember the sound of the plane crashing into the mountain, despite his close proximity to the crash. He was medically retired from the Air Force shortly after his discharge from the hospital. The crew had been flying a U.S. Air Force B-52 Stratofortress. They had been performing low-level navigation training when something happened. What exactly happened wasn't known to Captain Adler as he lay in the snow. The captain also didn't know that, of the 9 crew members on board, only he and the aircraft commander had survived. He was found just less than half a mile from the crash site. The captain of the plane, Lieutenant Colonel Dante Bulli, had landed in a tree. Despite the awkward landing, his parachute had successfully deployed, and his injuries were minor enough, if I dare use the term minor, to allow him to return to work in just 3 months' time. Unlike Captain Adler, Colonel Bulli could access his survival kit, which included a sleeping bag and a life raft, both of which helped him survive the night. The co-pilot of the B-52, Major Robert Morrison, was able to eject, but was fatally injured after striking a tree on his descent. Though Captain Adler was unaware of the fate of Colonel Bully and Major Morrison, he could guess the fate of the other crew members on the Stratofortress. They were dead. It was a guess, yes, but an educated one, as he knew that only the upper deck crew members, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the weapons officer, eject upward from a B-52. The two lower deck crew members, the navigator and the radar navigator, eject downward, an unfortunate predicament when flying as low as this plane was flying. The remaining crew members do not have ejection seats and must jump. The B-52 is not unique in this regard. There are other planes that have ejection seats that fire downward, and there are other planes, of course, that one must jump from whenever things go bad. But on the B-52, the crew without ejection seats must jump from either the open lower ejection hatch or open and jump from a fuselage door, a difficult proposition. There is a tail gunner on this plane, and he has a unique way of getting out. Located in the very back of the airplane and separated by quite a distance from the rest of the crew, the gunner has to first jettison the tail guns and then jump through the hole where the four 50 caliber machine guns used to be. On a low flight like this one, less than 500 feet up, traveling at over 300 miles per hour, and heading for a mountainside, there just wasn't time for anyone to jump. Even if they could, survival would be unlikely. It's been said that ejecting from a crashing airplane is bad, but jumping from a crashing airplane is really bad. Maine is a quiet state. Even today, it rarely makes headlines. As of the 2020 census, the population of the state was just over 1.3 million. At the time of the crash in 1963, the population was about 970,000. Or about 5% of the entire U.S. population. Today's census indicates the remoteness of the crash site, about 10 people or less per square mile. And I can only imagine it was much less than that in 1963. Captain Adler was less than 1/2 mile from the burning plane, but in this wooded, mountainous, snow-covered, and remote part of Maine, he was very alone. Even though rescuers were already searching, they were severely hampered by the snow. It was reported that snowplows had to cut a miles-long path through snowdrifts as high as 15 feet, or nearly 5 meters, in order to allow the rescuers to begin the search. As it turned out, they were searching in the wrong area. The rescuers were too far south and east, meaning the survivors wouldn't be found until the next day. The injured and exposed Captain Adler and Colonel Bully would have to fend for themselves in the snow and frigid temperatures for 18 hours. I've mentioned a couple of things so far that might have you scratching your head. Upward and downward firing ejection seats are certainly interesting, and I'll talk about the plane in a few minutes. I've also mentioned that the plane was too low for most of the crew members to eject or jump. I've also mentioned that the plane lost its vertical stabilizer and rudder, not the use of the stabilizer, but the loss of the actual physical stabilizer. That's a real whiskey tango hotel occurrence, right? A real what the heck occurrence. Airplane tails don't typically fall off in flight. So let's talk about what happened, and then talk about the factors that led up to this failure. This was a dramatic failure, but first, let's talk about a definition of a vertical stabilizer. The vertical stabilizer is the upward-pointing fin on the back of an airplane. The stabilizer includes the rudder. In the case of this version, the C version of the B-52, this part is huge, and it brought the total height of the plane to just a couple of inches taller than 48 feet, and it weighs about 2,000 pounds. And I say was as in the past tense, because later versions of the B-25 stabilizers were shortened by 8 feet, and so this uniquely identifiable characteristic of the Stratofortress then came more into line with what was common in other large aircraft. This part of the airplane keeps the plane flying straight and true. It prevents the side-to-side motion known as yaw. The rudder is built into the vertical stabilizer, and the rudder is used to initiate and control a left or right turn. The rudder is controlled by the pilot's feet on the control pedals. The vertical stabilizer itself does not move, only the rudder moves. Without the vertical stabilizer and without the rudder, the plane is unable to fly in a controlled manner. And as I say that, I know I'm setting myself up for failure because a plane can fly without a vertical stabilizer. It's been demonstrated many times by other aircraft. In fact, even a B-52 can fly without a vertical stabilizer, as this too has been demonstrated. Although this successful failure, if you will, was brought about in a testing scenario at 14,000 feet or 4,300 meters. That altitude provided time for the crew to figure things out and get the plane safely home. In the case of our B-52 in Maine, the plane was flying at about 500 feet, or about 150 meters, and the crew barely had time to eject, let alone time to figure out how to fly the mortally wounded plane. So, we have a large airplane flying really fast at about 500 feet above the ground in the middle of winter over rural Maine. Something happens and the tail falls off, which causes the plane to veer, dive, and crash into a mountain. Let's talk more about the plane and see if we can figure out just what happened. The B-52 Stratofortress first flew in 1952 and was introduced to the Air Force about 3 years later. This plane is still flying today, and it's somewhat famous, perhaps infamous is a better word, so it's perhaps somewhat infamous for being significantly older than the crews who fly and maintain her. This plane came online at about the time when Queen Elizabeth was coronated and President Eisenhower was in office. Today, the plane has been updated to include GPS, noise-canceling headphones, Bluetooth connectivity, and, for all I know, a phone app that will allow the pilot to start and unlock the airplane remotely. Of course, I'm just kidding about that last one, but the Stratofortress has been on the receiving end of many upgrades over the decades. Aerodynamics, engines, electronics, communications, weapons capabilities, and now, with recent and ongoing engine and technology upgrades, it's expected that the plane will fly into the 2050s, giving the plane a life expectancy of 100 years, give or take. By the way, I've intentionally only used the word upgrade and not the word new regarding the airplane. The last new B-52 came off the assembly line in 1962. The plane takes a crew of five, and there is no longer a tail gunner. A tail gunner was part of the flight crew for this particular version of the B-52 in 1963, but the tail gunner position at the rear of the plane was retired about midway through the Vietnam War. And a little bit about the tail gunner position, which came about during a time when enemy aircraft had to be close enough to see what they were shooting at. But by the early 1970s, planes could be shot down by missiles fired by pilots that were well beyond visual range. At that point, the gunner was moved forward to be with the rest of the crew, where the tail guns could be operated electronically and with radar. Then, in the early 1990s, during Operation Desert Storm, that very radar system was the cause of a friendly fire incident when an Air Force fighter jet fired a missile at a B-52, thinking it was an enemy aircraft in the skies over the Middle East. The guns, the defensive radar, and the gunner were permanently removed from the B-52 shortly after that. That was about 1991. Let me mention the B-52 Stratofortress's unofficial nickname, Buff. While each airplane's nickname is deliberately unique, like the Stratofortress, sometimes the unofficial nickname can be deliberately unflattering. Like in the case of the A-10 Thunderbolt, its unofficial nickname is the Warthog, or Airbus's A321, known in certain circles as Sausage, or the C-124, known as Old Shaky. And you can learn more about Old Shaky in episode number 4 of Radar Contact Lost. And then there's the Stratofortress, known to its close friends as Buff, which stands for Big Ugly Fat Fellow, or in even tighter circles, it's known as Big Ugly Fat F***er. On that note, let's move on. I I mentioned earlier that the B-52 was on a low-level navigational training mission. If you are on your toes, or maybe if you're a Cold War buff, you might say, hold on just a second, any airplane designed in the 50s was a plane designed to fight the Soviets. Any bomber designed to fight the Soviets in the 50s would therefore be designed to fly high and fast, to sneak in fast and high, drop the bombs, and then get the heck out. You would be correct. However, how things can change in the space of a couple of years. Yes, the plane was designed to beat the Soviets and radar at high altitude, but then the Russians improved their designs, and suddenly the Buff was a target that could be shot down. The Air Force did a 180 and changed the mission of high and fast to low and only slightly slower. The new mission was now to sneak in fast below the enemy radar and do it as fast as our ground-following radar technology and pilot skill and nerve would allow. This strategy was so new to the Air Force that this mission, on this plane, was the first time such training had occurred in the eastern United States. Unfortunately, the B-52 was not designed for this kind of low-level mission, and we have now arrived at the crux of this podcast's subject, the low-level crash of a B-52 into a mountain in rural Maine. So, what went wrong? Why did this relatively new and the most advanced Air Force bomber of the time crash? Simply, the weather and the design of the airplane combined to cause structural failure and loss of control. We've already talked about the plane itself, but let's talk about what it was designed to do. And I think then the cause of the failure will become evident. The B-52 has a surface ceiling of 50,000 feet, or about 15,000 meters, although bombing missions were usually designed for enemy airspace penetration at about 35,000 feet. The air is pretty thin up there, and the stress is relatively light on the airframe. At that altitude, not only is the air thinner, but you're not battling obstacles that pop up in front of you, and the input the pilot uses at the controls is much less. On the other hand, when you're flying 49,500 feet lower, the air is heavier and thicker, and it presses harder against the airframe. When you're just 500 feet above the ground, you have terrain, like mountains, to avoid. Sometimes the planes are even lower, much lower. I have it on third-person authority that dipping a wing in a turn could sometimes result in clipping a tree. And this is easy to believe if you check out some of the low-level flying videos on YouTube. Watch one video called F-16 Low-Level Flight Over Japan to see what I mean. When high speed is factored in this case the B-52 was flying at about 325 miles per hour, inputs at the control are firm and the stress on the airframe is far greater than at high altitudes. This stress, at times, can overwhelm the airplane by literally pushing it to its breaking point. And that's what happened here. This airplane, on its mission to simulate penetration of enemy airspace at low altitude, experienced severe turbulence. While the captain attempted to pull up to get away from the turbulence, a structural failure occurred. Metal failed and control surfaces were destroyed. The stabilizer shaft of the B-52 broke, and the plane's vertical stabilizer separated from the airplane. With the loss of significant control, the plane pitched right and downward quickly. The upper flight deck crew managed to eject. The lower crew members had no chance of survival. What about the weather? We already know that it was January in one of the more northern places in the United States. It was bitterly cold, and there was a lot of snow on the ground. A cold front had recently blown through, and the winds were brisk from the northwest across most of Maine. Air turbulence was listed as a contributing factor to this crash, but did the turbulence itself cause the vertical stabilizer to break and separate from the airplane? Turbulence and wind shear have damaged airplanes before. There are examples of wings being torn from airplanes flying through thunderstorms. However, that's not the case here. What happened with this crash was a combination of the low altitude the high speed, the pilot's strong inputs at the controls to climb above the turbulence, and an airplane not built for this kind of stress. Could the turbulence have caused the plane to lose control and crash? Yes, that's possible. Could this turbulence have damaged the control surfaces of the B-52? Maybe. Severe turbulence is powerful, but I'm not sure this situation was quite that strong. More likely than actual aircraft damage is the threat of significant and abrupt changes of altitude, something that must obviously be strictly avoided at low altitudes. This type of turbulence would be very uncomfortable for the passengers, and injury might occur if not properly fastened into their seats. So the captain wasn't trying to prevent the aircraft from braking. He was trying to save the plane from a sudden and abrupt change of altitude, the type that could lead to a crash. Let's talk about the type of turbulence that was happening at the time of this incident. In mountainous areas such as where this crash occurred, mountain wave turbulence, also known as lee wave or rotor turbulence, is common if certain factors are present. Number one, the wind flow across the area is perpendicular to or at a right angle to a mountain barrier having a steep lee slope. Two, the wind at mountaintop levels exceeds 25 knots. That's almost 30 miles per hour or about 45 kilometers per hour. Three, there is a rapid increase in wind speed above the mountain range for several thousand feet. And number four, there is a temperature inversion above and upwind of the mountain. These conditions can produce an oscillating wave downwind from the mountain range. The stronger the winds are across and above the mountain range, the stronger the wave turbulence will be, and the farther downwind the wave will propagate. My research into the conditions at the time of the crash site, on the western slope of Elephant Mountain, indicated a small valley between the two northeast-southwest-oriented mountains. A winter cold front, as I mentioned, had moved through the day before, and the surface analysis shows brisk northwest winds behind the front. These winds were running perpendicular to the mountain range. Just above the surface, the winds continued to be perpendicular to the range and a bit stronger, at about 15 to 20 knots. A bit higher, about 2,500 feet, the winds turn to a more westerly direction, but increase in speed to about 25 knots. Then, at about 5,000 feet, the winds are out of the north at 30 knots. With the terrain of the nearby mountain range immediately northwest of the crash site being about 1,700 feet, and a second peak of 2,500 feet just 2.5 miles northwest, the conditions were ripe for mountain wave turbulence. Given the strong winds across the mountain range and the wind shear with altitude above the crash site, I think it would be reasonable for the Air Force forecasters to brief the crew to expect moderate, if not severe, low-level turbulence through this area. I was not able to find the accident investigation report for this crash, and that would typically include the weather briefing that was provided to the flight crew. Nor could I find any report including the analysis of the black box or the cockpit voice recorder. This type of technology came online in the 50s, so I'm fairly sure that information exists, but in all my searching, I struck out. It could be that the crash report is still classified. I don't know, but given the type of mission, it's certainly possible. However, what is available is the weather data, and I gave it a look. My analysis here is only Monday morning quarterbacking for sure, but there might have been some vagueness to the mission briefing because the crew was given the choice of flying a simulated enemy airspace penetration run over North Carolina or a similar option over Maine. Who knows, maybe it was data overload for the flight crew, maybe it was a bad or underestimated weather forecast, maybe two low-level simulated enemy airspace penetration routes overwhelmed the Air Force forecaster or forecasters, and a small detail was overlooked. I just don't know. I do know, however, that localized low-level weather conditions and flight hazards are very difficult to forecast, and to do it right takes time. Mountain snowfall is a perfect example. In one place, you can have 5 feet of snow, and a mile away, there might be only a few inches or none at all. Accurate low-level turbulence forecasting requires the forecaster to not only be excellent in weather forecasting, but also to be excellent in geography. You've got to know where the mountains are and how they're oriented and how high they are. Either way, well into the flight, the main option over the northeastern U.S. was chosen by the crew. And I will add that an updated weather forecast for both options was provided while the crew was airborne. And with the updated forecast, the crew then chose the northern option into Maine. I don't know if the weather was again updated as the route into Maine began. Okay, I want to bring you up to speed on, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. This crash brought about changes to the construction of the B-52's tail section. As it turns out, this was not the only B-52 crash of this type. In all, there were five of these types of tail failures. Three occurred within 12 months of this crash. The bolts that led to the failure were strengthened, and this simple fix cured the problem. Another change helped to further alleviate this problem, a shortening of the vertical stabilizer. This produced a tail with less square footage and one less susceptible to the types of stresses that were causing the tails to fail. This particular crash happened to the tall tail B-52C variant. The shortened tail variant came along with the G model. Interestingly, the G model was released in 1958, 5 years before this crash. Several variants of the B-52 were flying at the same time in those days. Today, only the H model is flying, though the J model, one with new radar, new communications and navigation, as well as new engines, should be online by the end of this decade. And as with most accidents, the changes in design and material brought about by these crashes influence the design and construction of today's modern aircraft. Of the two surviving members of this crash, only aircraft commander Dante Bulli continued on in the Air Force. Captain Adler was 31 at the time of this crash. After being medically retired from the Air Force, he became a lawyer and later the mayor of Davis, California. He died in 2021 at the age of 90. Lieutenant Colonel Dante Dan Bulli, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, it's spelled B-U-L-L-I, lived to be 94. He flew in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. He was 41 years old at the time of this crash. As for the crash site, you can visit it today. There are a lot of aircraft remains there, and it is a popular Elephant Mountain hike and snowmobile destination. Gravel roads are now near the site, and a short hike can bring you face to face with the pieces of the once mighty B-52 Stratofortress. 15 years after the crash, a memorial snowmobile ride was established to honor those who survived and died on the aircraft. In 2013, 50 years after the crash, Jerry Adler attended a special Memorial Day service and he visited the crash site for the first time since his rescue. Also for the first time, he met his rescuer, Eugene Slabinski. Slabinski was an Air Force medic who was the first to reach the injured and nearly frozen pilot by helicopter. Both men were in their 80s when they finally met one another. As I wrap this up, I'd like to read a quote from Captain Adler at the time of the reunion in 2013. He said, "Deaths don't always occur in combat. This is a non-combat situation, a combat simulation. That's why we were down so low and seven men died. And people die all the time. It's not just Vietnam or Korea or World War II. Just give thanks that people are willing to give a portion of their lives over to help serve their country." That's all for this time on Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about this crash and about the B-52 Stratofortress, there's a lot of information online about the B-52, but not as much as I would have liked about this particular crash. If you come across the Air Force Crash Investigation Report, declassified, of course, please drop me a note. I'd love to read it. If you'd like to learn more about the friendly fire incident when an American F-4 Phantom jet fired upon a B-52 during Operation Desert Storm, there's an interesting article on aviationgeekclub.com. And there's a great video on YouTube showing the B-52 using its rearward-facing radar and firing its tail gun in a demonstration environment. Actually, there are several great videos on this topic. Just search B-52 Tail Gunner. And I checked into the snowmobile club that organized the memorial ride. They're the Moosehead Riders Snowmobile Club. I found a video of the ride on YouTube from 12 years ago, but their website doesn't seem to be active anymore. There are several current videos on YouTube of independent snowmobilers making the ride to the crash site. The winter scenery is gorgeous. I'd like to thank the team here at RCL. On the air traffic control side, we have former U.S. Air Force and FAA controllers Cindy and Michael Hintz and Tony Gorham. Tony and Cindy also take care of the airports and procedures research. On the weather side, we have meteorologist Chris Hebert and Nathan Stamford with expertise in climate and severe weather, respectively. Meteorologist Joe Spain from Risk Consultants provided me with the upper air data from January 23 to 25, 1963. And if you're thinking that must have been hard to get, you're right. Thanks, Joe. On the piloting side, we have retired FedEx Captain Michelle Acorn and FedEx First Officer Larry Gregory. The RCL team is a great team because of these talented folks. They make this podcast detailed and thorough and make sure that I dot the I's and cross the T's, and I can't thank them enough. With each new episode of Radar Contact Lost, I will bring you interesting but tragic stories of plane crashes from across the United States and from around the world. When these crashes involve the weather as a possible cause or as a contributing factor, I'll rely on my 40-year career as an Air Force, broadcast, and commercial meteorologist with a specialty of aviation meteorology to explain what happened and why. I'll also lean on my experts in air traffic control, meteorology, and piloting to peel back the curtain to take a closer look at what really happened. If you like this episode, give a like, leave a review if you can, and tell your friends. Word of mouth for a podcast like this is always the best form of advertising. On Instagram, follow @RadarContactLostPodcast. We're also on YouTube. If you'd like to reach out, send an email to rclpodcast1@gmail.com. That's rclpodcast1@gmail.com. And lastly, let me thank you, the listeners. Radar Contact Lost continues to do well on the podcast apps, and I'm happy to bring these stories to you, to all of you who have a love of weather, aviation, and history, just like me. Thanks for climbing aboard and settling in for the latest from the Radar Contact Lost team. I'm Dave Gorham.